From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1979 when a new show made its debut on PBS. This Old House began as a one-time 13-part series, but its success in that first season has led to 39 more. The Home Improvement Show, which follows remodeling projects over time, has sparked spinoffs, a magazine, and websites. Viewers can learn how to do everything from weather stripping a door to how to build a breakfast bar to how to save energy in your home. Now, the well-loved show is now celebrating its 40th season, and cast members are in Rochester today for a special event at the Hochstein School. This hour, we'll preview that event and talk with host Kevin O'Connor and carpenter Nathan Gilbert about the show and trends in the home improvement industry. In our second half hour, we'll be joined by local home improvement experts who answer your questions and talk about trends and the evolution of the industry. But first, the team from This Old House, Kevin O'Connor and Nathan Gilbert. Welcome to Connections. Let me start by saying that for me, this is a really fun conversation because I was born 3 months after the launch of this program back in 1979, and my parents watched Bob Vila throughout the 1980s. I'm curious to know if both of you, and I'll start with you on this one, Kevin, do you guys think that this is the program that really ought to get credit for the entire genre? You know, because after my parents were watching Bob Vila, they watched many iterations of This Old House. They watched Paige Davis on Trading Spaces and everything that came after. But was this really the genesis of this genre, you think, Kevin?
Oh, I think without any question at all. I mean, back in that time, there were very few networks even out there, let alone entire networks dedicated to home improvement. So This Old House was something that was new on the TV landscape, and it was actually revolutionary. You know, put the subject matter aside, this dragging cameras around the job site, up and down ladders, talking to, you know, non-television people. These were just carpenters and contractors who were working professionally at their trade, talking to them and making them the stars of a television show. Completely unheard of. There was nothing else like it on television for a very long time. So yes, it is unquestionably the grandfather of all this genre.
Do you ever, Kevin, look at other programs and say, come on, we do this better? That's a ripoff, or that's gimmicky. I mean, do you think that the original is still the best?
Well, I've got two thoughts on that. The other shows, believe it or not, aren't actually doing what we're doing. And if you think about what it is that we do, we are in sort of the education business. And the folks who we put on camera, guys like Nathan, they practice their trades professionally. I am the only person on this show who gets to speak who isn't a professional contractor. I'm just the guy asking the questions. Everyone else, when they're not, you know, making the television show, they're out doing their own work with their own companies. You know, Richard Chithui is a fourth generation plumber. So by contrast, the other shows, the thing that's similar is that there's a house as a backdrop. But other than that, the similarities fade away. Those things are about confrontation. Those things are about budgets. Those things are about flipping. Those things are about whatever they're about, and the house happens to be there. We are about professionals showing homeowners how to do things the right way. So I don't get hung up with the comparisons, and I don't judge them accordingly. Those shows are very popular. They provide a lot of entertainment for people, and that's fine. We're just doing something completely different.
Well, Nathan, your father ran a carpentry business. I don't think he ran a television studio. What do you make of the career path you've taken here? How surprised are you yourself with what you've been able to do and what you're doing with Ask This Old House TV?
It was really a cool opportunity. You know, as growing up, watching the show, you don't really think that someday you could actually be on it. Working with my father in the South Shore of Mass, you know, getting hands-on education into my 20s until I went into the Navy was a really enjoyable experience. And then when I was sitting at home and I saw this opportunity for an apprenticeship to work with This Old House, I jumped at it. And luckily I got picked. And the transition's been pretty good. You know, as an apprentice, it was very humbling. We had a lot of hot days up in Newton, Mass. But later when I got the call back to answer some house calls for Ask This Old House, you know, when the cameras are there, it's a little bit different. But at the end of the day, you're just doing what you love and just doing for myself. That's carpentry.
Talking to Kevin O'Connor and Nathan Gilbert from This Old House and Ask This Old House TV. They've got an event tonight, 6:30. They're going to offer a behind-the-scenes look into 40 years of home improvement, renovations, remodels, more. They're going to share some vintage clips, favorite moments, renovations from the series that inspired this genre of television programming. And you can still get tickets at WXXI.org. So Nathan's talking a little bit about, you know, his own career path that led to the program. I want to be careful, Kevin, asking this because I know this is probably the 100th time you've been asked, and I hate to be the host that asked it, but I have not heard you talk about it myself, so this is more indulgent for me and I hope for our listeners. You are someone who was watching this, and you came to the show as a fan of the show, and that path to the show is serendipitous, and it's really an awesome story. So for those who don't know it, tell our listeners how it happened.
Well, you're right. I have told it 100 times, but it ends well, so I'll tell it again. I grew up as a fan of the show, watching it with my dad, who was in the trade, with my brothers. You know, we enjoyed doing it. It's the thing that gave me my passion for, you know, working around the house with tools, doing it myself. I've never practiced it professionally, but I'm that typical homeowner who says, hey, let's renovate our own kitchen or renovate our own bathroom. That's exactly what my wife and I did when we bought our first house. It was a two-family fixer-upper. Nothing really worked, and we spent, you know, many years doing it ourselves. And very early on in that process of nights and weekends, when we, you know, ran into something that we couldn't figure out, we actually wrote This Old House, the magazine. The Ask This Old House television show, our second show, wasn't on the air yet. So we wrote the magazine, but they were producing the first season of Ask This Old House. And so that concept is, instead of the full-blown dream renovation, it's the same guys going door-to-door, ringing doorbells, as Nathan does for us now, among other things. And they took my letter, they rang our doorbell, and they said, hey, we'd like to have Tom Silva and Jim Clark, the painting expert, come and do some stuff with you guys. They did. I was psyched. You know, I was like, Tommy Silva's in my house? This is unbelievable.
Yep.
We had half a day of filming. I took my picture on the front porch with those guys, cracked a beer, and thought, man, that's just awesome. That was really cool. I was psyched to meet those guys. And then literally out of the blue, a month later, they called up and they said, would you like to be the host of This Old House and Ask This Old House? It was that much out of left field. And I spent about a nanosecond thinking about it and said, yeah, sure, why not?
it's been a good marriage ever since. And our listeners and our viewers are excited to have a chance to meet you in person. So let's talk a little bit about what you've seen, because that happened for you in what, 2002, Kevin?
2003, correct.
2003.
Yep, that's when I started.
So you've been on the program, obviously, longer than Nathan has, but I want to get a chance to ask both of you this question. For homeowners and for people who are trying to kind of either fix up their house, whether to sell it, whether to improve it for long term, there's always trends that happen. And we've been reading about what, you know, sort of what the industry experts think are the current trends. What is the biggest change you've seen, Kevin, in your 17 years on the program that either homeowners are asking for or not asking for? What's sort of moving around?
The two biggest things I would say is the open concept. In almost every renovation we do, we start off with the homeowner saying, I'd like to open this place up. Mm-hmm. I want my kitchen to open up onto the family room. I want to break down the walls and stop the house from being smaller, chopped up rooms and make it wide open. And I think that's a nod towards informality. We become much more informal with our lives. And the other big trend is taking back outdoor space and turning it into living space. So it's not okay anymore to have just a patio or walk out to the backyard. People want, you know, big decks. They want built-in furniture. They want to bring out TVs and cooking stations. We are living outside because now we have the ability to do it. We have these sophisticated things, all-weather grills and furniture and that type of stuff. So we've extended our homes into the outside. Those are the two big trends that I see.
Interesting. Nathan, you want to add to that?
I think one of the biggest things I've been seeing recently is the advancements in being able to do like your own security, your own cameras at your home. A lot of people are installing their own systems, and I think that's a pretty cool thing to see. But along the lines of that too, a lot of young homeowners are going for more of a modern look. A lot of steel, a lot of cable. The appliances are more modern, more tech savvy. That's a big trend I've seen.
Nathan, let me follow up to Kevin's point about the open concept, and I will put this squarely in the asking for a friend category. when it comes to opening up space, people will take a look at their own layout and they'll think about, well, this wall could come down, or boy, wouldn't this be great if we could open up the kitchen into the dining room, or this room into this room. But obviously you got to know if the wall can come down or if it's a support wall. Is there an easy way to tell?
It's a little bit easier in more of a modern home. Being up here in New England, the way the houses were framed is a little bit more regular. Rooms were smaller. They were meant to be closed off and heated in the winter or opened up in the summertime. So it's tough to tell if the joists are running across, landing on that wall. In a more of a modern house with more of modern building materials, if they had laminated or steel, it might be easier to take down those walls. The best thing to do is see if you can cut a little access and stick your head up inside there and check the way the joists are going if you can't tell for sure. Or maybe if you're lucky enough, if the house has been around more recent, if you can get some hands on some blueprints.
Okay. But obviously the rule of thumb is, I mean, if it's a support wall, it can't come down. I would think, right? I mean, that support wall is a permanent structure. There's no way around that?
So that support wall can come down. You can resupport. You can add in engineered lumber to clear the span. It's just going to take a little bit more time and money to navigate around that.
Hmm. Kevin, for you, 17 years for you, but 40 years for the program. You know, not giving away too much on what people are going to see in person, but give me a sense for what the live program is going to be like.
Well, we're going to reflect back on that very first season going back to 1979, and what I think we're going to try to do is people might be they may enjoy seeing the images and hearing that old sound. What we're going to try to do is help people have a better appreciation for just how revolutionary it was 40 years ago, something that I had, you know, talked about a little bit earlier. I don't think we remember how primitive TV was. I don't think we remember how formulaic it was, in studio, scripted this, you know, traditional news. This thing came out of nowhere, and it literally grabbed the nation's attention. It was a small little production locally, and within 6 or 8 months, it was a national hit and stayed there for decades. So we'll talk a little bit about that, but we will also push forward, and we'll talk about some of the most exciting things that are going on with our brand. Nathan is one of them. We found him through our Generation Next initiative, where we're trying to bring younger people into the trade, and he was one of those people who's now on our show. We'll explain that in detail, the need for it, where it's going, and we'll talk about the projects that we're doing currently and sneak peeks about the projects that folks who watch the show will see for the upcoming season, stuff they've never seen before. So it's going to be a little bit of a look back, but also very much a look forward.
We're talking to Kevin O'Connor and Nathan Gilbert from This Old House and Ask This Old House TV. The live event tonight at 6:30. Tickets available right now at WXXI.org. So some of our listeners think about changes they'd like to make in sort of two categories. One would be for an investment. In other words, can you get your money back? Can you improve the value? Can you sell? Another would be sort of for a forever change because, you know, home, you want to live there. And, you know, you're not really necessarily worried about resale. So let me ask both of you, and I'll start with Kevin on this. Do we think too much about, well, if we do this, we can get the money back out of it? I mean, is most of the time, are we not going to get that money, or are there certain parts of the house where we probably will?
So most people do not put stuff into their house when it comes to an investment calculation. Most people do not have a rental or a flip. Most people are saying to themselves, this is where I'm going to live. I may not live here for 10 years because I hope to have a family and move out of this, but this is where I'm going to live. And for those people, I do think people often think about, well, if I spend this, will I get it back? What they don't figure into that calculation when they're designing their kitchen and they're saying, you know, if I put in the 6-burner stove, will I get the extra money I spent on that back? What they don't put in that calculation is the utility that that feature may give you for the 5 or 7 years that you live there. This is where we live. This is where we raise our kids. This is where we entertain our friends. And so every day that we enjoy the decisions we make, the things that we pay for, is a day that they are paying us back. So to simply say, if I spent an extra $1,000 on that stove, will I get an extra $1,000 back in 5 years when I sell the house? That is an incomplete calculation in my book.
Okay, Nathan?
I would say, you know, if you're going to, you plan on living there for a while, you know, like Kevin says, definitely a worthy investment because you're going to be able to use those things over the years. If it's more of a flip or you're just going to live there in a short period. Things to keep in mind are stay away from large additions where you might need to get into the septic, because that's very costly and you're not going to get the return. Other things would be paint colors. You want to go more neutral. You want to have a color that complements the neighborhood. Don't grab something too bright. Makes it a little bit more difficult to sell.
Talking to Kevin O'Connor and Nathan Gilbert from This Old House. And, you know, Kevin, as he told his story, when he was a viewer and someone who was a guest on the show became the host, I'm sure there have been some interactions with either viewers or people on the show that stand out. Kevin, is there one that is either the quirkiest or most surprising over the years for you?
Wow, there are a bunch. you know, there are houses that people look at on the show and they say, why are you guys working on that thing? And I can remember a moment in Roxbury, Massachusetts, when we were working on a two-family that had been abandoned for many years and had suffered all of the indecencies of an abandoned home, a roof that had collapsed and water that had come through for almost a decade. I was walking down the street next to Norm as we were about to do a scene on mic, ready to go, and he put his hand over his mic, turned to me and said, "We should have blown it up." And it kind of stopped me in my tracks, because when the godfather of home improvement, who seems to have resurrected any building out there, turns to you and said, "That one needs to go," I was like, uh-oh. But we were off to the races. We fixed it anyway. You know, what it's taught me is that with the right professionals, you know, with people who really know what they're doing and have the experience, you can save anything.
Wow. Nathan, do you have a favorite episode so far in your tenure there?
I've been doing a lot with Ask This Old House, and I think one of my favorite ones so far was actually my first trip. Then I got to fly out to Portland, Oregon to fix a scorched floor. And it was kind of a funny story where the husband had been doing some ironing on a small table, and he put it right down on some Douglas fir. Only scorched the surface, so we were able to fix it quickly. But no one could figure out why he did it, when he did it. No one had any recollection of that, but we were able to fix it up for him, and it looked like brand new when we left.
That's awesome stuff. And again, listeners, you're going to chance to kind of reminisce and hear some of the great stories at the live event tonight at 6:30. Now, we have frequent conversations on this program with members of the Landmark Society of Western New York, which identifies and helps find opportunities to restore historic properties, sometimes old houses and sometimes old warehouses and different kinds of buildings. And I'm curious to know, you know, Kevin, what do you think the value is in looking at the historic properties in our communities that maybe in a generation ago we would have looked at and said, that's a knockdown, that's a start over? I think there's a trend toward finding ways to kind of redevelop instead of just saying more big development. What do you think the value is in restoring historic properties?
I think the value is high. I think anytime we have a diminishing resource, we have to be very protective of it. I think anytime we have something that will go away permanently, we have to be very protective of it. Not burdensomely so, but I do think that we have to look at these things and realize that once it's gone, you don't get it back. And that's not to say that everything old is worthy of being saved, but lots of things that are worthy of being saved can be at the risk of development. And so, you know, we have had to butt heads with the historic districts and commissions over small things. You know, can we replace the windows, update the windows, these types of things. But those are good little conflicts that we don't mind having. We don't generally support, you know, the full teardown. As I said, in the right hands, you can save just about anything. And what we found is that while an old house fixed up is not for everyone, there are a lot of people out there who actually put it in higher value than other houses. And so when done right, you're probably going to find somebody who wants that house. So we end up on the side of, yep, let's, you know, save these things if they're worthy. Let's treat them properly. And just know that if we don't, we're not getting them back.
Nathan, you agree? Do you think modern know-how gives us a better chance to save things that maybe a generation ago we would have thought were unsavable?
Yeah, I really agree with Kevin there, saying it's once it's gone, you're not going to get it back. There's nothing like driving through a neighborhood, an old neighborhood that has the charm, and each house might be a little bit different, and you see all the old styles of architecture that they worked with back then. One of the great things nowadays is so many companies are starting to do reproduction, hardware, lighting, and it's making it more affordable to bring these houses back even more efficiently.
Nathan, I'm curious to know if you think the work that you're doing with Ask This Old House TV and This Old House is serving as a mechanism to introduce young people to the skilled trades. I mean, that's something that the Landmark Society, for example, here in Western New York, is hoping that people will gravitate to in larger numbers because there's more uncertainty in the job market at large, and there's this maybe a feeling of a little bit more security in the skilled trades for those who are willing to go into it. What have you seen?
I really do think Ask This Old House is helping, especially with their connection with more of a social media platform, YouTube, where young kids or young adults can go on and see how easy it is to make these repairs in their homes if they have the right tools. It's definitely very beneficial.
How solid a career? How stable a career?
Right now, business is booming. There's not enough young guys in the trades. There's not enough young females in the trades. And there's tons of openings. Every time I talk to another contractor, they're always looking for a young, eager person that wants to work and just do a 9-to-5. And that, but the problem is it's tough to find a young kid who has the patience. You know, in today's society, a lot of them get it right now on their cell phone. It's instant. Take some time on a job site to learn the skills, and it's tough to find that, but I think there's a lot of young, eager kids out there.
And Nathan, did I read correctly that you talked to members of Congress on Capitol Hill?
I did, briefly. Kevin moderated that event. That was a really cool experience where we sat down with a panel of a lot of really established people, and it was nice to hear that the discussion was happening about the lack of skilled trades opportunities, and also that there's a lack of funding and that the government is going to try and do better every year as we go on to get more money into apprenticeship opportunities.
Yeah, Kevin, realistically, what's the role of government there?
I hate to go there, but sadly I'm not that confident or encouraged by what they're up to. To be honest with you, to Nathan's point, there are a lot of people out there who are looking for young folks. And a big part of the equation, I believe, is letting young people know that it is not just a respectful profession, but also a lucrative one. I think we've been talking about it incorrectly, and I think we've been characterizing it incorrectly. Big push for college, fine with that. It's not for everybody. And it doesn't have to be that college only leads to a white-collar job. You know, college can lead to a very good blue-collar job. So it's a conversation that has to happen within our families. I was talking to a friend of mine who was sitting at the dinner table with his fiance, and the father kept talking about the other sons, or I should say the other daughters, and how they married well, doctors and lawyers. And here he was a successful contractor, and it never sort of came up. So
wow.
I really think it's kind of at that level, you know, because you're just like, why aren't we talking about this with our kids? Mm. You know, when my kids ask me about it, I say, listen, it's not necessarily about being a plumber, Luke. It might be about owning your own business when you're Nathan's age. Who gets to do that if they go through the traditional course that I went through, working at a bank? I'm never going to run a bank. But here's Nathan running his own business at a very young age, and he's been doing it for a while. So it's a whole different way to talk about it, and I just think it's going to happen amongst our family, amongst our friends, in our school, as opposed to some, you know, distant, you know, far-off bureaucracy.
Hmm. Before we wrap up with the guys from This Old House and Ask This Old House TV getting ready for the event tonight, through WXXI and WXXI.org for tickets for this event. I just want to ask you, Kevin, as the host of the program now for 17 years, a little bit about how you see change versus stability on a program like this. Because, you know, when you are, you know, technically you're in entertainment. I mean, you're people are going to tune in because they're going to learn something, but they're entertained by it. And there is always this push to change. And yet I feel like with public television, there is more of... I'm a homer. I think there's more of a focus on sort of quality and consistency and just a good product as opposed to always looking to reinvent. But at the same time, I'm not behind the scenes with you guys talking about what you want to do differently or what you think has and should change. Tell me about change versus making sure that this old house is what people have always known it to be.
So I think it goes back to something I said earlier about the differences between what we're doing and what those other home improvement shows are doing. And again, this is not a knock on them. They are providing entertainment with the house as a backdrop. And in that situation, fresh faces, change, and all of these different things to the drama are good, right? Because they have to constantly keep our attention. We're in the trust business in this old house. We put on people like Nathan and Tommy and Norm who you can trust. And the longer you're with those people, the longer you have that conversation with those people, the more chance you have to trust them. So in our world, it is a lot about stability. It is about familiar faces. It is about hearing them over and over again to know that now you can rely on them. And we certainly have to be progressive and forward-looking. Norm's not going to do it forever, and hopefully Nathan will do it with us for the next 30 years. He's going to have to build up his credibility with the audience over many years. So we're more in that PBS mold where we give trusted information, education, and inspiration. And so I think stability is key for what we do.
This Old House, our listeners know, airs Sundays at 4 o'clock on WXXI-TV and Mondays and Fridays at 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. on WXXI Create. The live event tonight is at 6:30. They're going to offer behind-the-scenes looks into 40 years of home improvement, renovations, remodels, and more. And there's tickets available now at WXXI.org. That event with Kevin and Nathan this evening at the Hochstein School. Have a great time, Kevin and Nathan. Thank you for the expertise, the great work, and really the education that you and the team provide. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Thank you, Evan.
I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we're joined by RIT professor Sarah Burns, who has written a new book called The Politics of War Powers. She argues that the U.S. Constitution creates an invitation to struggle between the legislative and executive branches of government. And she says the president has little checks and balances when it comes to how he uses the U.S. military. She'll talk about it. Then we'll talk about how local colleges and universities are prioritizing diversity on campus Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And as we continue, I'm told to remind our listeners that single tickets really only available tonight. The doors are going to open by about 5:45. And if you still want to get in to see This Old House essentially live tonight at Hochstein, there should be single tickets at the door. But you're probably not going to find anything on WXXI.org anymore. They've sold a bunch of tickets. So cash your check is best. And if you want to be there at the door at Hochstein School tonight for the event that starts at 6:30, they'd still love to see you. But that's the situation there. And I want to welcome a couple of guests in the studio. Adam Frank is the owner of A. Frank & Co. LLC. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Christopher Brandt. Chris is an architect with Barrow Architecture PLLC. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, first, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do with Barrow?
I'm one of maybe, I guess I'm now maybe middle staff, still young in my early 30s, but our firm has been the sort of specialty firm here in Rochester and for 40 plus years of working in the historic preservation field on any number of old buildings throughout our greater community. So everything from the George Eastman House to many ecclesiastic buildings on East Avenue, and then most recently the Little Theater, which is just about ready to open back up.
We love the work there.
I'm glad you do.
We're homers. Thank you very much. And Adam, tell us what A. Frank & Co. LLC specializes in.
We specialize in residential, mostly kitchen, baths, and small additions. We like to transform people's homes one at a time, and we're a small family-owned operated company that enjoys what we do.
Well, during our brief break, I got a rule of thumb that I'm going to remember here, and it's a little horrifying. But I asked Adam, you booked out pretty far. You said about a year in advance right now if you want A. Frank & Co. to do some work, about a year.
Yeah, for a larger project, we're about a year out. And honestly, it takes, the design process and from start to finish until you're ready to break ground on a project. Usually it takes 3 to 6 months, depending on the size of the project.
And your thought was any contractor worth their salt probably should be booked up pretty far in advance.
All the guys I know locally that are worth it are booked that far, yes.
So Adam and Chris, and there's no obligation to answer for the home team of public television, public broadcasting, PBS, et cetera. But since This Old House launched 40 years ago, I mean, I spent a lot of time watching shows like Trading Spaces, things like that, that are really kind of the dominoes that have fallen in television and product creation ever since this show came out. Adam, what shows have you watched over the years?
What's funny for me is I'm kind of coming full circle today because I fell in love with the industry when I was a youngster, and I was watching This Old House on the weekends. I would watch Bob Vila walking around house to house and kind of see what he was doing, and fell in love with the trades back then. And as I was growing up and watching the program, I saw and learned how he does things here and there, and still to this day, that's how I do them.
So those were some of the early memories?
You got it.
I love that story. That's great. What about you, Chris?
I think for me as well, I definitely grew up watching this old house. And then as I got older, I can't say enough about what the Lammer Society does in our broader community. So I walked in there as a, early high schooler, maybe middle schooler, and was sort of encouraged to sort of find my own passion within our broader community's history. And that sort of led me to the profession I now partake in. I think another great, although not as entertaining because it's not television, you got to sit down and read, but Old House Journal is another sort of great long-lived resource that sort of focuses on the more nuanced sort of approach to working with older buildings versus new build.
Well, you heard some of the team from This Old House address that in the conversation we had in our first half hour. Once again, a reminder, tickets only available at the door tonight for the live event that starts at 6:30. So if you want to attend, that's the only place that they are left. They have been selling, in fact, all throughout this hour and in the days leading up to this event tonight. So let me go and I'm going to read some feedback from listeners that I think both of our guests, though they do, their work differs in some ways. I'll start with George, and I have to say, this email came in this morning, and it's from George Vila. I mean, I looked at the last name, and I went, huh. Doesn't mention Bob. He says, as a homeowner, the search for reliable contractors to help with my home improvement projects can be very challenging. I do my best to research reviews and obtain referrals from friends and family. However, I still find that many contractors don't call back, don't show for estimates, or won't follow up with estimates if they do show. Once underway, the quality of the work can be lacking, and I feel it is necessary to check on things throughout the project. For example, I attempted to have the interior of my house painted and went through 6 painting contractors before I found one that followed through the entire way. I try to be as flexible and understanding as I can, but my perception is, unless you have a very expensive project, many contractors will simply pass on the work. What suggestions does the panel have to help avoid these issues or maybe help the process move along more smoothly? And George says, I've been a big fan of This Old House since I was a child. I still watch every week. I hope so, George Vila. Your dad was awesome. I have no idea. It doesn't even sound like he was related. George, thank you for that. And I think George's frustration is probably, he's probably not the only one who's been frustrated with a contractor here and there. Adam, I'll start with you. What would you say?
I'm happy to field this question. You know, we get this a lot. I would say on half the sales appointments I go to, there's a contractor horror story that the client shares. I can do my best to ease their mind at that time, but, we do everything we do, and I have not spent a dollar on advertising in the 18-plus years that we've been in business. It's all word of mouth. Those are the people you want to look for. You want to look for the people that really enjoy their craft. And I would say, do your homework as best you can. You know, when I give referrals or client referrals to someone that's asking about my work, I always give them my last 3 clients, no matter what the outcome of the project was. It's always my last 3 clients. So you can get a real true feel for how the company is run, and they can ask whatever questions they need to ask.
Great stuff. You want to add to that, Chris?
Yeah, I agree with sort of how Adam conducts his business. But I would say, like, as a good starting point, you always want to ask for referrals and be able to, don't be afraid to, go talk one-on-one in person with the homeowner that had that experience with the contractor to really get a better understanding of how they've accomplished their work there. Additionally, it's also worthwhile to sort of contact design professionals within the field that have had experience with a whole, slew of different contractors and may be able to tell, in our experience as an architect, have we had a good experience with such and such contractor or the painter or a carpenter and things like that, as well as the Lammer Society also maintains a list of recommended contractors and subcontractors for use of the public. So
yeah, and I think that referral is interesting in different ways. I mean, I think when I've been part of panels evaluating people in journalism who are coming in and applying in various places, whether it was here or in my past lives and other places, everyone wants to send you their best stuff. They'll send you, either a reference, referral, or, just the work they've done that they think stands out, which I think is helpful, But then I would ask, okay, now give me your last week's worth of work. I just want to see what you've done in the last week. Not what the best stuff you've done over the last 5 years, but just what you've done in the last 5 days. And so to Adam's point there about, you know, just the last three, not just the best three, that's very, very helpful. Adam Frank and Chris Brandt joining us here as we talk about contracting, the kind of work that you might do at home or in our community. Their work takes them into homeowner spaces, also historic places for the Landmark Society. And we've got them here because they happen to be fans of This Old House just as we are. And the team from This Old House is in Rochester today. So when you read about trends, you know, I'm sure there are certain things that come and go, but then there are certain kind of age-old questions. Let me start with just a homeowner kind of question, and then we'll sort of broaden here. People want to know about, you know, what are the best investments? And Linda in Parenton says, quote, "I've heard that finishing a basement adds no value to the resale of a house. There's no return on that investment. Is that true?" Adam?
I would say that depends on when you say you're finishing a basement, what you're doing. If you add an egress to your basement, a second form of egress to your basement, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but I believe that that adds that square footage of the basement to the home's size, which in turn would definitely increase the value in the home.
Okay, go ahead, Chris.
Right, and that's Adam's absolutely correct with that. So when he's saying adding egress, we're essentially talking about a window large enough for a human to pass through. So you're usually going to have a pretty deep window well with a set of, you know, steel stairs or a little stepladder to get you up out to grade. But when you have that second form of egress by code, then you're able to sort of inhabit that basement for a sleeping space. So you could have an extra bedroom down there. That opens up a lot of possibilities of being able to sort of legally finish and improve that basement beyond being a more general sort of utility space.
So maybe not necessarily right, Linda, that it's not that there's no return on the investment. I don't think our guests here would ever predict in a general way that you'll get 100% or, you know, whatever the rule of thumb may be, but it's probably not zero. Though when they talk about egress, this is something that I encountered when I looked into finishing a basement as well. I was told that if you want to take what is an unfinished basement and finish it for, you know, Chris mentioned a bedroom or other, you know, sort of the way we would think of it as a finished space, it legally has to have an egress, which is essentially just a different way out in case of an emergency.
Correct.
You mentioned a deep welled window, but
yes,
something that you could get out.
Correct.
If you can't use the main stairwell down to the basement. Legally, you have to, is that right?
Yes, yeah, and that also comes into play, too, when you're finishing a attic space where you have, a egress window. And there's some nuance with that as far as the scale of the building, whether or not you're going to have a whole second staircase or if you can get away with an egress window and a ladder. But what also comes into play is the potential of sprinklering in a residential structure that you end up having finished space that's more than two stories above grade. So that's a whole nother sort of can of worms almost if you're going up instead of down with what space you're finishing.
Interesting. And what would you say, Adam Frank, if you had a contractor tell you, we could do that basement, and you know what? An egress could be $2,000 to $4,000. You don't need that. We'll do it without it. What would you... Because I've heard that, I won't mention any names, but once in a while you get someone saying something like that. Would you trust a contractor?
It's a double-edged sword. I think it really depends on the use of the basement, right? So if you were to come to me and say, I want the basement finished and it's going to be a bedroom down there for one of my kids, I'm not touching the project unless we do it legally and we're going to pull permits and we're going to do it properly. If you're going to use it as a laundry room and it's going to be you up and down the stairs and you just want it to look prettier, you might be able to slide by.
Okay. And when you say slide by, I assume you mean there's a very different legal standard.
Correct.
For a bedroom versus it's still a laundry space. What about a workout space? Moving more into needing an egress?
That's a good question for Chris.
And it more comes into play when you have that sleeping space, really, because then that's sort of almost guaranteeing that you're going to have occupancy sort of throughout the day as well as sort of during the night when you're not as sort of cognizant. And that's where it really sort of kicks in. But also part of what Adam was sort of alluding to there with just cleaning up your laundry space. When you're just cleaning up your laundry space, you're not changing the use. You're not changing the programmatic use of the space. And so that's not going to necessarily kick in a review from your municipality with how the code sort of applies to your house. But if you're putting a bedroom in, there was no bedroom in the basement. You know, that's a wholly different change of how you're using the space versus just cleaning up your laundry room.
Got it. Okay, on the phone, Bob in Rochester with a question for our guest. Go ahead, Bob.
Good afternoon. I have a project-specific question. I have a house that was built in 1890,
And in the bathroom, the vinyl tub surround, which is probably 50 years old, has died. It's cracked, and I know there's water getting behind it. And so I want to pull it out. But the question I have is the plaster that's behind it. I know it's, I do know for a fact it's plaster, not drywall. Should I take that out and replace it with cement board and a waterproof barrier, or can I just clean it and put a waterproof barrier over it? And I'll take the answer off air. Thank you.
All right, Bob, thank you. Go ahead, guys.
So at least with that specifically, I would always sort of caution. I think Kevin and the guys from This Old House sort of touched on it when they were talking about removing a structural wall, but I can't emphasize enough the importance of doing sort of small investigative openings to really understand, you know, what is the underlying substrate, what's the condition of that. So it's hard to really say, you know, you're not going to really know until you get that tub surround out, and then you can assess the soundness of that plaster backup. So if it's not sound, you know, it's starting to let loose of the lath and falling off, and that's not really a sound substrate that we want to attach new tile or sort of plumbing parts to, and that would then be where you want to sort of take that out and start fresh from the studs. But really, it's something you got to take a look at after you get that surround out.
Okay. You want to add to that?
I would say I agree mostly. I think 9 times out of 10 in our projects, unless we're working on an inexpensive rental update for a client, most of the time we will completely gut back to the studs because you get a fresh start point. If you have plaster on your walls, likely those walls are not all true and straight, so it's much easier to fur or add on to those studs that are there to get you a nice true surface so that when you're setting your new tiles, which are usually larger format tiles these days, it's easier to set those tiles.
You know, 1890, I think you mentioned the house is 1890, and, you know, the wheelhouse for what Chris does as an architect with Barrow tends to be, again, historic properties. I find, I love when people have sort of old farmhouses or 1890s houses, but what you mentioned in his specific case, I think is probably a good point to elaborate on. If you've got a property that's that old and you're doing work to it, I think what you mentioned there, if I was understanding the words like substrate and important, correctly.
Sorry, throwing around jargon.
Well, just understanding underlying conditions before making changes, or just to understand how things have aged.
Correct.
How precarious is work in homes that are, you know, pre-1900?
I mean, that can come down to, you know, how was the house modified over time? So I can't tell you how many times that I've seen. So say that the house didn't originally have plumbing in it, and the plumbing was put in with some new bathrooms in, I don't know, maybe the 1920s, 1930s. And, you know, the plumbing didn't, you know, trying to get the slope of the sanitary lines right didn't quite work out too well. But in order to get it to where it needed to go, they, you know, maybe cut large holes into joists and compromised the structure of the floor. So seeing sort of when you begin sort of inserting things that weren't there originally, that's where it can crop up the potential of complications. It's not a guarantee, but it's certainly, if you don't have a contractor that's as sort of upstanding about their work, they might take those kind of shortcuts, and that's where you start getting into these complications of things being modified that shouldn't have been, and not necessarily an inherent fault of the original construction.
Sure, and that's why I asked the question I did about support walls, which I think probably come up as they look at that trend of opening up space. You know, I get why everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people want a more open floor plan, but it's easy to think that we've got the know-how. Let me ask both of you, what are the kinds of jobs where you think you've got a friend who's not in your line of work, because I'm gonna try this on my own. What makes you nervous? What makes you most nervous, Adam, if someone is trying to do the work on their own at home?
Especially in an older home, as municipalities change their codes and code requirements and materials that we're using change over the years, we run into on almost every project where we open up a wall and it's not up to code. Framing lumber is larger now than it was then. So you open up these walls and sometimes the plaster that's there or the lath that is there is actually acting as structure. The exterior sheathing of a house, the way they used to do it, can actually act as structure, which we don't use anymore. We just use OSB or plywood. So some of these things where in a newer home, you can just take drywall down and put some new drywall or some tile back up. On an older house, if you start taking the plaster down, I've actually seen walls start to drop and have to support them in other ways. So,
ooh, wow. You want to answer that, Chris, too? What makes you nervous when people are trying to do DIY it?
I think anything, I mean, as far as the DIY, this is anything dealing with structural changes to a house. So if we're like removing walls, changing openings in walls, anything related with the heating, the plumbing, the electrical systems, that if someone knows just enough to be dangerous, starts to get a little scary. When you're just kind of doing cosmetic things, even like, you know, say refinishing floors or even installing some cabinets in a kitchen, that's not as worrying to me than when you really start getting into the guts of the house, that can really open up a whole Pandora's box.
All right, Diana Rochester wants to know, what is the best way to reduce your heating bill in the winter? Keep the heat at a consistent temperature at all times or turn it down when you aren't home? She says she's got a pretty cold house. Wood floors, gets pretty cold in the winter.
So from personal experience, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how best to utilize my own money towards my personal home as far as lowering my heating bill. So I've got an old steam boiler that heats my house. But sort of for starters, your biggest savings, biggest return on investment is going to be insulating your attic or your roof, because the vast majority of your heat loss in any home is through the roof. And then from there, we saw really marked savings with getting a programmable thermostat, like she's sort of alluding to, where you have it sort of set down a few degrees, 3, 4, 5 degrees when you're not around or when you're sleeping and you don't need the heat as high. And we noticed big savings on both accounts, when we did the insulation, then about a year later when we did the programmable thermostat.
Okay. Anything you want to add there?
I would say I agree with everything Chris said. The only thing I would add is, we use the new smart thermostats in almost every project that we do, and they allow the thermostats to actually learn your trends at home, and the thermostat will know when you're there and when you're not there to heat and not heat. I will say this, heat rises, and if you start from the ground up, many times we go into a home and the floors that you're walking on the first floor are freezing because there's no heat in the basement. I mean, that's just going to radiate cold all the way up through the floor, through the first level and on up. So I would say, in addition to from the roof, a lot of times if you look down in your basement, your rim joist or the area just above your foundation, below your floor framing on the first floor, a lot of times has no insulation. And if you insulate that alone, as well as put a dump zone or two in your basement, it often helps.
Yeah, that's a really great point as well. And I think that the guys from this old house also talked about that, just general weatherization efforts. Mm-hmm. If you don't have weather stripping on a door, or if you've got sort of cracks in some of the siding, or you've got some open gaps around your rim joists, any kind of air infiltration during the winter is going to vastly affect your sort of both sense of comfort as well as heat loss. So really, those are the big three there.
Is there one quick thing on that list for people like Diane could do to maybe, that maybe is within reach, that isn't a major project that will help keep heat in during the winter?
Well, I mean, so for doing a what I'll call a cheap weatherization, I've got a number of friends. My parents still sort of do this, but if you've got some issues where maybe you have some faulty weather stripping on a door or window that you're only using seasonally, they have sort of a peel away weatherization sealant. You can go to a Mayer Hardware over in the North Winton Village and get your sort of the peel away weatherization sealant, and you can seal some of those areas where you're feeling that sort of weather that sort of air infiltration coming in during the wintertime. But I would also say something you can do for free is get a energy audit, where they'll do a blower door test, and that blower door test will bring out right away, you know, where is the air coming into my house? Where are the leaks? And that's something that a lot of, you know, your heating and cooling companies, any company that might install insulation for you, they're actually required by law to do that. That's a great way to sort of gain that knowledge about your specific house and be able to sort of have a more nuanced idea of how you're going to approach the problem.
That's great stuff. Before we wrap here, some 2020 trends according to Forbes. Forbes writes that discretionary luxury remodeling is slowing overall in the market, with some product categories facing the more severe headwinds, including high-end cabinets, flooring, roofing, dimensional lumber. They don't have counters, and I have a friend who recently got soapstone counters and loved the look of them, was surprised at how quickly they can be marked on the surface. I mean, they're pretty soft. So what's the most expensive countertop right now that you're doing?
I mean, most of the countertops, quartz and granite, are about the same price-wise.
Does that include soapstone?
Soapstone is in there. It's about the same price. There's easy ways to fix the soapstone. We can talk offline.
That would be probably helpful for people who have that problem. Is there a most popular that you're doing right now?
I would say quartz is the majority of what we're doing. I would say about 70% of what we do is quartz, because you can get a uniform color and a uniform look. Some of the nicer ones still look pretty natural.
So the quartz is not the top end of the cost?
Quartz and granite are pretty similar in price.
Okay. And when it comes to cabinetry, high-end cabinets, people still interested, or are you seeing any change there?
Most of what we do is mid to high-line semi-custom cabinet lines.
Okay. Last minute here, some of the work that you're doing, what's on the menu now for what Barrow's doing and what you're doing for the Landmark Society?
So we have a handful of projects in the pipeline at the George Eastman Museum. So we're sort of in the midst of finishing the reconstruction of the colonnade overlooking the formal gardens. And then we have a large window restoration project coming up there. We're always doing little projects at the Charlotte Genesee Lighthouse. They're one of our favorite clients. I've been working for them for 20 plus years. And as they get funds available, we do sort of incremental restoration of that great historic site. We're always down in Cornell doing some projects for Cornell University. But yeah, we're always around, always helping long-term clients as well as fresh and new clients as well.
No, that's great. I live in Charlotte. I love what you've done with the Lighthouse, and obviously we love what you've done with the Little Theater. Thanks for that work. Chris is an architect with Barrow Architecture, PLLC. Christopher Brandt, thanks for the expertise and the time.
Thank you.
Great having you. And Adam Frank, owner of A. Frank & Co., LLC. If you look up A. Frank & Co., LLC, just be prepared to wait if you want them. It's too bad. That's what happens when you've got somebody who's good. Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me.
And once again, our thanks to the whole team from This Old House. You can see them tonight at 6:30. Tickets are sold out online. If you want to go, you're going to have to show up at the door. Single tickets probably will still be available tonight. Bring cash, and they'll see you tonight at 6:30 at the Hochstein School. Thanks to Bob volunteering with us today. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.